This episode deals with crimes involving a minor and may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. This episode is dedicated to the memory of Joseph John Aliperti, husband, father, grandfather, and former Nassau County Police Department detective. Joe, you will be missed. Jalique Rain Walker came into the world under difficult circumstances. Born to a mother who was addicted to cocaine, the newborn struggled to survive and was given up for adoption within 2 days. As a result of his medical condition, Jalique experienced developmental and personality issues. In the first 7 years of his life, the young boy bounced through 6 different foster homes. In the 6th, things seemed to be going well until Jalique's issues resurfaced and the family realized they could not give him the environment he needed. Not long after, Jalique moved into his final home. In October of 2007, when Jalique was 12, his adoptive father called a crisis hotline explaining that the family didn't know what to do with him anymore and wanted to reverse the adoption. The hotline advised them to send Jalique to another home for a short period of time to give both sides a chance to settle down. On November 1st, Kerr picked his son back up from the home, and by the next day, he'd be missing. Kerr alleged that he awoke in the morning and found his son gone, but the longer the story went, the less it made sense. Evidence didn't add up, details contradicted one another, and Kerr would become a person of interest. At that time, the family severed all cooperation with authorities and moved out of state. What happened to Jalique Rain Walker? Was this a case of a child running away and getting in over his head? Or does someone he knew and trusted know exactly where he is? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 78, The Vanishing of Jalique Rain Walker. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the disappearance of 12-year-old Jalique Rain Walker. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show.
Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated.
I wanted to wish a belated happy birthday to Alicia, who turned 33 on May 6th. Your sister Wendy contacted me and asked me to wish you a happy birthday. And it was just such a sweet and kind email, I couldn't resist. So I hope you had an amazing birthday. As one final note, I'm sure as you've noticed, I'm getting over some allergies and a head cold right now, so apologies for the way my voice sounds throughout this episode. Today we examine the 2007 disappearance of Jalique Rain Walker. It's a difficult case with few facts available. This is Episode 78, The Vanishing of Jalique Rain Walker. Jalique L. Rain Walker was born on August 2, 1995 in Albany, New York. Albany, the capital of New York State, is located on the west bank of the Hudson River approximately 135 miles north of New York City and boasts a population of just under 100,000 residents. While some disturbing details are known about the circumstances surrounding Jalik's birth, much of that information has either never been revealed publicly or has simply been lost to the confusion of time. We do know for certain, though, that Jalik was born to a mother who, at the time, was actively using and addicted to crack cocaine. Statistics show that there are approximately 750,000 births each year in which the child was exposed to cocaine while in utero. During the 1980s, when crack was becoming an epidemic, there were a lot of advertisements and warnings about the incredible detriment caused to children whose mothers used drugs during pregnancy. At the time, it was believed that this kind of exposure resulted in children being born with severely reduced mental capacities as well as major social problems. As time has gone on and technology has evolved, some of this has changed, with a greater understanding, and there's a more precise list of possible outcomes. It is now shown that children born under these conditions will likely experience behavioral issues, deficits in cognitive ability, more specifically usually targeting speech and memory, as well as brain function being altered in the areas of attention and language. The full impact is not yet known, as studies persist longitudinally to determine how cocaine use impacts a child from birth throughout his life. Jalik was given up for adoption just 2 days after he was born on his mother's kitchen floor. Again, a great deal of detail about his birth parents or initial home are few and far between. However, at the time of his birth, Jalik had to struggle with overcoming an addiction to cocaine as caused by his mother's use, and this definitely played a role in his development. Jalik was said to experience violent temper tantrums, or fits, during which time he was completely inconsolable. The child would rage depending upon the cause, and when he experienced these outbursts, he often frightened and concerned not only other foster children, but foster parents as well. As a result of this, in conjunction with the typical function of the foster system, the young boy would find himself cycling through foster homes. By the time Jalik was 7 years old, he was in his sixth foster home, and the constant disruption and lack of consistency also contributed to his developmental issues. I should note, Jalik was part of what is known as therapeutic foster care or treatment foster care. Unlike normal foster care, children in this system are usually suffering from significant social, behavioral, or emotional medical needs, and are granted only to foster parents who have specialized training. This system is designed to provide a safer environment for raising the child rather than the normal foster care system, and, in many ways, is more cost-effective and socially rewarding than the alternative, which would be to put the child through a residential treatment system. So, while Jalik did cycle through 6 homes in his first 6 years, these homes were run by foster parents who had trained and had likely experienced being with children who had similar issues in the past. In multiple articles discussing Jalik's issues and state of mind, attachment disorder has been alluded to. Attachment disorder covers a wide array of mood and behavioral disorders related to a person's inability to form attachment to primary caregiving figures. Typically, people experiencing attachment disorder may show a variety of symptoms, including unexplained withdrawal, fear, sadness or irritability, a sad appearance, not seeking comfort or showing no response when comfort is offered, the absence of a smile, watching others but opting not to take part in social interactions, no interest in playing interactive games with others, and failing to ask for help. Suffice it to say, a child with attachment disorder who also experiences violent outbursts would provide a difficult challenge for even a highly trained and experienced foster parent. This is, in a way, what occurred when Jalik was with his sixth set of foster parents. Jalik came into the foster custody of Larry and Jody Schoen, who were experienced caring parents. For 4 years from age 3 to 7, Jalik remained with the Schoens, who had actually begun the process of attempting to legally adopt the child. It was said that, while it could be challenging, for the most part Jalik thrived in their household. As a result of some cognitive issues, Jalik had a speech impediment, which caused him to pronounce the letter R as though it were a W. and even his own name was somewhat difficult for him to say, so he quickly acquired and began going by the nickname Jay. While it was clear that some cognitive issues still existed, this didn't seem to play a role in Jay's intelligence, with Jody later stating, quote, "He was as bright as could be. As soon as he could read, he read a book a day. I mean, he was amazing," end quote. According to the Schoens, Jay was an active little boy who loved running and playing soccer. In addition to being an avid reader, Jay had a fascination with dinosaurs, and they gifted him many dinosaur toys which he would play with for hours. The Schoens did the best they could, providing a stable, loving environment for Jay, but as the years progressed, certain issues seemed to be out of control. Jay's tendency towards violent outbursts was becoming too much, and while the husband and wife did their best to keep things under control, they were slowly becoming aware that they had little power to assuage these incidents. When describing one of these outbursts said to last around an hour, Jody explained, quote, "He said, 'I hate you,' and the look and feel was as if he was older, he would have killed me," end quote. The Schoens did their best given the circumstances, but everything changed one afternoon when, while in the middle of an outburst, Jay allegedly physically attacked one of the Schoens' younger daughters. This was considered the straw that broke the camel's back, and with the Schoens concerned for the safety of their other children, they made the difficult decision to not adopt Jay and to return him to the state for new placement. According to Jody, it had simply become overwhelming for them, and they didn't know what to do anymore. They were extremely protective of all of their children, including Jay, but when he became a source of danger, they felt they had few options. In later discussions, the Schoens did express that while they did not regret their choice, as hard as it may have been for them, there was a hesitance and a concern for what would happen with Jay. It wasn't long before Jay would find himself in his final foster home, one which the Schoens couldn't help but be concerned about. In 2002, Jay would find himself in the home of Stephen Kerr and Jocelyn McDonald living in Greenwich, New York. Greenwich, located along the western border of Washington County, is a small town in upstate New York with a population of just under 5,000 residents and a racial makeup that is 97.8 Caucasian. Jay, being of both African American and Caucasian descent, stood out amongst the extreme Caucasian population. The situation at first seemed to be everything that one would want for Jalik. He was brought into a home in which the family had already adopted a daughter, three other biological sons lived there, and both Kerr and McDonald appeared very excited about the prospect of making Jay a part of their family. I should note, there's some confusion revolving around Jay's name. When adopted by Kerr and McDonald, Jay received the last name Rainwalker. I don't exactly know where that name comes from, but Jay, along with the little girl the family adopted and their three biological sons, all have the last name Rainwalker. I would love to explain it to you, but I've never found an explanation that I can actually verify. Early on, everything seemed to be going well. Jay was happy, or at least there's no reports of him being unhappy or appearing to have experienced any abuse or negative treatment. Kerr and McDonald would ultimately pursue and succeed in being granted full adoption of the young boy. After a difficult early life and moving from home to home, it appeared that Jay had finally found a permanent residence. Of course, there were some details which would later be revealed showing that perhaps not everyone believed that all was well in the home. Jay's adoptive grandparents, Dennis Smith and Barbara Reilly, McDonald's mother, expressed that while they believed Jay's parents had wanted the best for him at the beginning, they may have changed their opinion over time. According to a letter penned by Smith, there's a great deal of scrutiny given to the parents during the potential adoption. During that time, they're looked at closely, the home is checked, there are visits and a sharp degree of watchfulness. Jay was subjected to psychological counseling to help deal with his issues, as well as to maintain an understanding of his feelings in regard to the adoption and the home in which he lived. However, when adoption is finalized and the judge rules in favor of the process, much, if not all, of that scrutiny begins to die down, and soon it's left to his new family to ensure that the child is taken care of properly. Essentially, the parents are given options in terms of departments they can reach out to for assistance if necessary, but agents will no longer be sent to check on the child's well-being or progress. According to Smith, while he believes McDonald and Kerr started off with the best of intentions, that may have shifted, and during times where Jay became difficult, there was a debate about trying to reverse that adoption. In an interview, Reilly later stated, quote, "I really feel like Jocelyn and Steven's intentions were noble in the beginning, but they learned to work the system," end quote. Both Smith and Reilly have expressed concerns that Jay and his adoptive sister may not have been treated equally or as well as the family's biological children. Reportedly, and I have to say all of this is hearsay, Jay and the little girl the family adopted were treated quite unfairly. There have been multiple statements addressing the idea that while the biological children were allowed to stay up late, play outside, have lots of toys, and have snacks, Jay and his adopted sister were often sequestered, not allowed to play with others, had limited access to toys and games, were not given snacks, and were often put to bed as early as 6 p.m. Kerr and McDonald denied these statements, claiming that Jay had been treated just the same as the other children, and that despite their sincerest efforts, they were unable to break through. It should also be noted that reports of the time suggest that the home in which Jay lived was not a typical home. It's been said that Kerr and McDonald preferred a, quote, non-traditional lifestyle, and that their home had no running water, outhouses rather than restrooms, and that the electricity supplied to the home came from a generator which was only run for a few hours a day. It's been further suggested that the family all slept together in the same room, and that much of this was done due to the goal of trying to be environmentally friendly. The home itself was described as a 20-foot by 20-foot cabin. Again, there are so many details in this case which don't add up, and this is a puzzle I can only show you the pieces of, not the completed picture. The situation with Jay seemed to worsen over the years, or so his adoptive parents would claim. While the young man had been growing and developing over the 5 years that he was in their home, descriptions of Jay vary. We do know that, by the age of 12 in 2007, he was physically described as standing 5 feet 6 inches tall, but weighing only 105 pounds. In the media, Jay is often described as gangly, thin, with long limbs. According to Kerr and McDonald, things were getting difficult with Jay, and they were struggling to handle his outbursts and behavioral shifts. According to them, Jay was suffering from a number of psychological issues, including making statements of both a homicidal and suicidal nature. Strangely, though, despite these alleged issues, at no point was Jay taken back to counseling or prescribed any medications to assist with the problems. On October 23, 2007, Stephen Kerr made a frantic telephone call to a crisis hotline. The call, placed a little more than a week before Jay would disappear, was allegedly in response to an issue stemming from a homeschool group to which Jay belonged. Kerr alleged that Jay had threatened to sexually assault another child in the group, and that this, combined with outbursts at home and growing anger issues, had made raising Jay unmanageable. Reportedly, Jay had become very hostile in his behaviors in recent years, and during times where he was angry or having a tantrum, there was little which could be done to calm him down. It was clear that Jay's emotional issues were beyond the abilities of his adoptive parents. Kerwood allegedly asked during this phone call how he might go about reversing the adoption process. Rather than leaping to any major decisions, such as giving Jay back, the counselor on the line suggested instead that Kerr consider sending Jay to a respite care instead. There's a process by which adoption can be reversed, but the state will typically go above and beyond to try and keep a child with his adoptive family, sometimes not fully taking into consideration what may be best for the child. However, a 12-year-old boy with emotional issues who is taken back to the state is unlikely to find a permanent family, and so respite care is often suggested to try and give the family and the child a break from one another. Respite care is essentially like foster care, but on a much less major scale. For any period of time, from a few hours to a week or two, Jay would be able to be moved into the foster home of a specially trained set of caregivers who would then work to ease the situation. This was not the first time Jay had been sent to respite care, and the family to which he was sent, that of Elaine and Thomas Person, had experience working with Jay in the past. While their care for Jay was never to be long-term, they did care greatly for him and had experience in this area, having fostered more than 45 children over the years. Jay was not the first child suffering from attachment disorder that they had cared for, and they were highly aware of how tense and difficult that can be. The Persons cared for Jay for just 6 days, though he had been brought in mostly to remove the child from a tense situation and take care of him as preparations were being made to deliver him back to his adoptive parents. In a letter, Elaine Person later wrote, quote, "Jalique was a beautiful, sweet, intelligent, generous, and loving child with some behavioral problems. His adoptive parents were just unable to parent him," end quote. Ultimately, the Persons would be in custody of Jalique until November 1st. At that time, Jalique was returned to the care of his adoptive parents, though arrangements had also been made to move him directly from the Persons' home to a different home for respite care. This second trip, however, would never take place. When Stephen Kerr picked up Jay from the Persons' home, he was brought back to a home in Greenwich. The home, located in the 10 block of Hill Street, belonged to Kerr's parents, and this is where Kerr and Jay would stay that night, with the rest of the family being back at their normal home. Why Kerr made the choice to bring Jay here alone has never been directly answered, though many believe that since they were allegedly planning to send him back for another stint in respite care, they simply didn't want to bring him back home just to remove him again and disrupt his life. Others have speculated that McDonald was done with Jay and no longer wanted to try and raise him and was, therefore, opposing him returning to the home at all. Again, there's some confusion about this home, too. In some reports, Kerr's parents lived in the home and were present when Jay was brought there. I've even seen some articles suggesting that Kerr's parents became aware of Jay's disappearance when they found his bed empty. However, other reports have stated that while Kerr's parents owned the home, they didn't live in it at the time, and that was when Jay was brought there. Only he and his father were present. Still, I've read yet other accounts that the parents did live there but were out of town on a vacation at this time. Regardless, what we do know is that, according to official reports, Stephen Kerr is the last person to have seen Jay alive. On the evening of October 31st, 2007, Kerr alleges that he put Jay to sleep and that all was well during that time. When he awoke the next day, November 1st, the day where Jay was to be sent to another respite home, he found his son's bed empty and the child missing at approximately 7:30 a.m. According to Kerr, Jay had left behind a note which read, quote, "Dear everybody, I'm sorry for everything. I won't be a bother anymore. Goodbye, Jalique," end quote. Over the course of the next hour, Kerr claims to have searched for Jay, calling out his name, looking around the neighborhood, and double and triple checking the home. When he was unable to locate Jay, he called the police department and officially reported his son missing at 8:57 a.m. At the time, upon viewing the note and hearing of Jay's troubles combined with the respite homes, it was assumed that Jay had run away. When police responded to the call, they quickly began gathering information about Jay and any possible areas he may have run off to. When asked if he'd taken anything with him, Kerr initially reported that a duffel bag and Jay's favorite stuffed animal were missing, though these items were later located in the garage, suggesting that all Jay had taken with him were the clothes on his back. In a strange detail, Kerr would go on to explain that he hadn't found his son's bed empty that morning. Instead, in addition to the note, he'd found that Jay had stuffed clothing and pillows beneath the blankets to make it appear as if he was still in his bed. This is certainly something people have done in the past, though if one is to leave behind a note explaining that he's leaving home, trying to trick someone into believing you're still in bed doesn't make a great deal of sense, but we are dealing with a 12-year-old. A massive search was launched looking for Jay. His description was put out to all local media and reporters, and they descended on the family. Very rapidly, Jay's disappearance had become headline news, and organizations from all over the country were reaching out to offer their assistance. Beyond just strangers who wanted to chip in, many of the foster parents who had previously housed Jay also wanted to try and help. The Persons, as well as the Schoens, were very concerned, as were Jay's adoptive grandparents. Kerr's parents' home was located in a remote area with a lot of woods and lakes nearby. The initial concern for investigators was that the 12-year-old boy wouldn't last long in the elements, especially as winter had nearly set in and the temperatures in upstate New York can fall quite low, especially at night. The search for Jalik initially consisted of multiple police departments, the New York State Troopers, and volunteers familiar with the terrain of the area. Authorities utilized helicopters, tracking dogs, ATVs, horseback, and also employed infrared cameras on planes and helicopters, but were unable to locate anything suggesting where Jalik may have gone. According to Kerr, Jalik had no access to money, and so it was considered unlikely he'd have taken any kind of mass transportation. The family did, however, posit the possibility that Jay may have hitched a ride along busy Route 40 and may have been heading towards New York City, though their reasoning for this theory has never really been explained. It wasn't long after Jay was reported missing that police began to find the circumstances surrounding his disappearance suspicious. Both Kerr and McDonald were questioned by authorities, and while they participated early on, multiple detectives later referred to them as being highly uncooperative. While suspicions about their behaviors grew, investigators began digging into the days and hours leading up to Jay's disappearance. Kerr had alleged that after picking up Jay from the respite home, he had driven directly to his parents' home, but phone records seemed to contradict this statement. Kerr told police that he'd received a phone call at approximately 8:15 p.m. while driving Jay from the respite home. Cambridge Greenwich Police Chief George Bell later stated, quote, "He told us he was in front of Henry's garage in Melrose when he received that call, but we know for a fact that he has lied to us about that because the cell phone records show the call was received in South Troy. He was nowhere near the route he told us he took home," end quote. Troy is located approximately 30 miles south of Greenwich. When police tracked down the individual who had actually called Kerr that night, this person described Kerr as behaving and seeming agitated over the phone. Kerr gave police a detailed accounting of his travels, though he did not include any detours into Troy. Faced with this information and believing the story to be manufactured, authorities requested that both Stephen Kerr and Jocelyn McDonald submit to polygraph tests. McDonald did take part in a polygraph, which she passed. To this day, Kerr has refused to take part in a polygraph, and it was around this same time that the family began withdrawing from participating openly with authorities. While Jay's former foster parents were highly active in that search, his adoptive parents seemed withdrawn and, to some, disinterested. It wasn't long before the FBI got involved in the case, at the invitation of the Cambridge Greenwich Police. Part of their work involved trying to nail down Kerr's comings and goings from October 31st to November 2nd. During their examination, surveillance footage was brought to their attention, having been captured by security cameras at the Glens Falls National Bank branch in Greenwich. The footage shows a van, which matches the description of Kerr's van, driving by the bank at approximately 12:16 a.m., some 8.5 hours before Jay would be reported missing. While authorities could not confirm that it was in fact Kerr's van, they believe it was, and that the footage contradicts his story, in which he stated that once he and Jay arrived at his parents' home, he had never left. Jeffrey McMorris, a lawyer hired by Kerr, later stated that it was not Kerr's van that had been captured on camera that night. At the time, authorities requested access to the van to process it for evidence, but this request was denied. With little to go on, suspicion about the parents, and no sightings of Jay, authorities found themselves frustrated. Now, in many missing persons cases I've covered, families will maintain the same home, leave the rooms exactly the same, keep the phone number the same, in hopes that at some point their missing child will find them. This does not apply to Kerr and McDonald. Less than 4 months after Jay disappeared, the family packed up their home and moved to West Rupert, Vermont, 20 miles to the east and just over the Vermont state line. When asked about the family's point of view and their lack of cooperation with authorities, their lawyer responded, quote, "They don't want to give up the idea that he's still going to come home. I think there's a certain reality, but they're still hopeful. I think the police came to their conclusions in a short period of time." End quote. When approached by the media for comment, Kerr was somewhat evasive and had little to say, blaming authorities for his own lack of knowledge about the investigation into his son's disappearance. The following is an excerpt of Kerr speaking to a reporter.
"I'm not privy to much of the investigation because the police are still working on the assumption, partially, that I did something wrong."
Sadly, little developed during the investigation. While authorities maintained that they found Kerr to be evasive and untruthful in his statements, they did believe that McDonald had been very direct and forthcoming with them. Things took another turn when the Persons, the family with whom Jay had been sent for respite in the days leading up to his disappearance, contradicted the runaway note theory. According to Elaine, when Jay had been dropped off with them, he came along with a lot of homework. In addition to the homework, Kerr advised the Persons that Jay was being punished for the threats he'd made in the homeschool group, and that he was to write notes of apology. The Persons have adamantly argued that the note which Kerr produced as proof of Jay running away was in fact written while the child was at their home, and that it was in reference to the trouble he'd gotten into, not about running away. Making a home-cooked meal can be incredibly difficult when you've got a busy schedule. Thankfully, there's Green Chef. Green Chef is a USDA-certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable, with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Green Chef lets you choose from a wide array of easy-to-follow lifestyles with selected organic ingredients. Recipes are quick and easy with step-by-step instructions, chef tips, and photos to guide you along. Meal plans include paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, Mediterranean, heart smart, lean and clean, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore. Enjoy clean ingredients you can trust, seasonally sourced for peak freshness. I personally love the beef saltado patties. They look delicious in the photos, and making them was so quick and easy. I simply followed the instructions, threw in a few ingredients, and 30 minutes later was sitting down to a delicious, healthy meal. Green Chef not only provided me with amazing food options, but also made it so quick and easy, I can't wait to make more. To try Green Chef yourself, and to receive $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/trace. That's greenchef.us/trace. That's an amazing deal, and you don't want to miss out. So visit greenchef.us/trace for $50 off your first box today. The divide between authorities and Kerr and McDonald grew only wider when McDonald's parents, Dennis Smith and Barbara Reilly, lost communication with their daughter and son-in-law. All of this seems to have come as a result of Jay's adoptive grandparents siding with police, in believing that whatever happened to Jay, if anyone had the answer, it was likely Stephen Kerr. Over the course of the next few months, authorities received and followed up on multiple tips and sightings regarding Jay, though these never panned out. One major tip led authorities to bring cadaver dogs to the Battenkill Country Club, at which time the dogs indicated at a small pond. The pond was drained, though no remains were ever recovered. It was yet another miss in a long line of false hopes. Searches were also conducted across the state line, in Vermont, near areas where the family had been known to hunt and camp in the past. Another tip, an anonymous note received by the newspapers, alleged that Jay was alive and had been picked up along Route 40. The letter strangely read, quote, "Jalik still alive, needed a foot soldier for this war on drugs. Picked him up Route 40, post 30. He's okay, no fake. He says ask his mama and papa. Who are the Macaroni family? My cat named Diamond? Why does Franti yell fire? Don't try to look. We are no here. End quote. While the family's lawyer alleged that this letter had been written by Jalik, authorities disagreed. While no official suspects have ever been listed, Stephen Kerr began being called a person of interest in February of 2008. As time passed, authorities became more outspoken about the fact that while they hoped to recover Jay alive, the more time passed, the less they considered that a possible outcome. Soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. Eventually, the Major Crimes Unit of the New York State Police Department got involved in the case. On the five-year anniversary of Jay's disappearance in November of 2012, investigator Gloria Coppola spoke at a press conference, and for the first time, the nature of the investigation was publicly changed, with Coppola stating, quote, "It is not a runaway, it is a presumed homicide," end quote. Chief Bell spoke openly about the family's lack of cooperation, their belief that they were investigating a child homicide, and the fact that in the 5 years since Jay's disappearance, they'd received hundreds of tips. In his description of his missing son, Kerr had described Jay as wearing a yellow fleece pullover. Bell acknowledged that they had in fact recovered that fleece. While details are scarce, it appears Jay's adoptive grandmother found the fleece in the family's old home, at which time she provided it to authorities, and the fleece did result in cadaver dogs being taken down to a property in Troy, New York, the town that Kerr's phone pinged in, but he denied driving to. The search of the property unfortunately yielded no results. Divers also searched the Hudson River nearby, though again, discovered nothing. When asked for comment about the change of status of the case, the family's lawyer responded, quote, "They firmly believe their son is out there, safe, alive, and will come home someday. I don't know what would have prompted police to make this change," end quote. For the most part, Jay's case went quiet. Authorities continued to work it, and a group made up of adoptive grandparents, volunteers, and former foster parents created a task force focused on drumming up attention. A $25,000 reward was offered for information leading to Jay's whereabouts. Billboards were placed along Route 40 bearing Jay's image, and flyers were dispersed all across the country. Sightings of Jay have been reported over the years, as far away as California, though none have ever led to Jay. In February of 2016, police believe they may have had a tragic break in the case. A hiker discovered a skull partially buried in a wetlands area along the Hudson River, some 35 miles south of Troy, New York. Chief Bell was contacted when a forensic examination of the skull determined it had likely belonged to a boy between the ages of 10 and 13 years old. While this was certainly not the outcome investigators wanted, it appeared to be the first major lead they had found. According to Bell's statements at the time, it was believed the skull had been there for between 5 and 10 years, whereas Jay had disappeared 9 years earlier, fitting that potential profile. 3 months later, though, in May, authorities confirmed to reporters that the skull did not belong to Jay, and that further examination verified the skull belonged to a man much older than Jay had been when he disappeared. It was another blow to investigators who have struggled with finding anything in this case. In interviews with prosecutors at the district's attorney's office, multiple statements were made that while there is evidence, and the DA does speak to the police about this case, they do not yet feel they have enough to guarantee a conviction, and they have no desire to risk losing out on justice by tempting double jeopardy. Unfortunately, whatever evidence may be necessary to finally sway the pendulum towards arrest has not yet been discovered. Nearly 12 years have passed since Jalik Rainwalker was last seen, and over the course of those 12 years, two primary theories have been suggested. The first theory examines the possibility that Jay may have elected to leave the home of his own volition, but ended up becoming the victim of foul play. While authorities have stated countless times they no longer believe this to be a case of Jay leaving on his own, they can't officially rule out that Jay may have left home and found himself in a bad situation. The second theory, and by far the most popular, is that whatever happened to Jay is known by one person, his adoptive father, Stephen Kerr. Kerr is the only individual who has ever been listed as a person of interest by authorities, and it is known that he lied to investigators during the initial days of their search. While Kerr remains adamant that he had no part in his son's disappearance, neither he nor his family have publicly spoken without first passing through the filter of their lawyer since within the first weeks of Jay's disappearance. When last seen, Jaleek L. Rainwalker was described as being biracial, African American and Caucasian, standing approximately 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing 105 pounds. Jaleek, or Jay as he is known, has brown hair, though at the time of his disappearance he had blonde highlights and wore it in a 2-inch afro-style cut. Jay also has green eyes. Jay has a slight speech impediment, and there are several moles on his back. Jay was reported to have last been wearing a gray t-shirt with a dragon on it, blue jeans, and black canvas high-top shoes. His father also claims he wore a yellow pullover fleece, which may or may not be the one later recovered by authorities. Jay was last seen in the 10 block of Hill Street in Greenwich, New York, in November of 2007. If alive today, Jay would be 23 years old. Jaleek Rainwalker came into life in a tough way. From the very beginning, the odds were stacked against him, but through multiple foster homes, he found those who cared for him, and do to this day. While there was likely joy and excitement the day he was adopted, many believe this was the beginning of the end for the 12-year-old who would go missing from the home of his adoptive grandparents. Following his disappearance, the stories simply didn't make any sense, and the facts don't add up. For nearly 12 years now, many have wondered what became of Jay, and who may hold the answers to that question. While suspicions abound, for the time being, the answers remain elusive, and justice is held at bay. Hopefully, though, a resolution is not too far away, and the dedication and devotion of the police, Jay's former foster parents, and his grandparents may finally be able to discover the truth and find closure in its light. Cases involving children are hard. Cases involving children who have suffered through so much are even harder. I couldn't help but be thinking about Christian Ferguson, whose case I covered a few weeks ago as I was writing this episode. I'm not a parent, so there are intricacies here I could never fully understand, but the idea that people can be as twisted as they are when it comes to children will forever bother me. All around the world, there are good families struggling to bring a child into their home, while elsewhere, there are families that have children they don't want, don't treat right, and, as we're all well aware, far, far worse than that. By all accounts, Jaleek was a sweet and kind young boy. Yeah, he had outbursts and he had fits, but these were all tied to brain development issues connected to the manner in which he was born. It's understandable that as a parent, foster or otherwise, one might struggle with this. I don't hold ill will towards anyone who fostered Jaleek and simply couldn't do what needed to be done, couldn't support or provide him the environment or the care that he really needed. But in all of those cases, when things got too hard, the call was made and Jaleek was returned to the system. I'm not saying the system is a great place for a child to be, but it's a hell of a lot better than wherever Jaleek is now. Unfortunately, I tend to agree with investigators and believe that it's highly unlikely that Jay is still out there alive somewhere. It's heartbreaking to imagine what could have been. What could Jaleek have become? What kind of a man would he have made? He had the world in front of him, but from the get-go, there was always something hindering his advancement. He overcame so much, was putting it together and working towards building a life as a preteen. He was smart and read. He was focused and loving. Yes, he had issues, but who of us doesn't have some issue? Unfortunately, what could have been, we may never know, and the future that Jaleek could have made was destroyed before he had a chance to even begin his life. 12 years old is far too young. There really aren't a lot of options here either. There's only two theories to discuss. It seems pretty clear to most who have examined this case that it either went one way or the other, but the belief is, whichever way it went, Jaleek didn't make it out alive. The first theory, partially inspired by the alleged note, suggests that the 12-year-old may have gone off on his own, perhaps as a result of the respite care, or knowing that his adoptive parents didn't want him anymore, maybe as a result of the incident that occurred. That we may never know. Children do run away, but rarely does a child run away and within hours have hundreds of police searching and is somehow able to slip by everyone. So let's examine it, and let's just for the sake of argument say that Jalik did decide to run off in the middle of the night. There's not a lot of places for a 12-year-old not dressed for the cold of an upstate New York November night to go, at least not a lot of places that are going to be safe. Jalik had a couple of options. He could have run into the wilderness, though how many 12-year-old boys are willing to go running into the darkness of the woods in the middle of a cold night on their own? Sure, some will, but it doesn't seem that likely. I can't speak to Jalik's state of mind at the time, but I know when I was 12, I wasn't going running in any dark wooded areas in the middle of the night, but maybe he had more courage than I did. So that's a possibility. Jalik could have wandered off into the wilderness in which there are countless threats from dangerous terrain to wild animals. Almost anything could have happened under those circumstances. The problem becomes when that wilderness is being combed by police and searchers as infrared cameras soar up above and not a single thing is found. Not a sighting, not a shoe, not a scrap of clothing, little footprints in the dirt, nothing. Tracking dogs never picked up a scent in those areas, and the only time cadaver dogs did pick up anything, it led to nothing. So, could a 12-year-old boy wander into the woods and somehow escape all modes of detection? Yeah, but it's not that likely. So, he could have gone the other way. Instead of heading towards the wilderness, maybe he wandered the streets, walking through dimly lit neighborhoods in the cold morning dew. Passers-by could have seen him, stopped, anyone could have offered him a ride, with good or bad intentions. What I suppose you have to ask yourself is how many people are prone to abducting small children also happen to be driving around with nowhere to go in the early morning or late night hours on the off chance that they just happen upon a child to abduct, especially in a small town of less than 5,000. Again, statistically, it just doesn't seem all that probable. Jalik didn't have any money on him. He couldn't call a cab or hop on a bus. So if he made it a great distance away from the home, it could only have been through the aid of someone else. The problem with all this is nobody saw him. No one driving home from a party or off to work. No one walking their dog or just staring out the window. It's not as if the police received a ton of calls saying that a boy had been seen walking by himself overnight or in the morning. And within hours, everyone in town basically already knew to be on the lookout. You'd have to imagine that someone would have remembered seeing a young boy out on his own. This doesn't happen. So it would have had to have been one of those instances where Jalik was spotted by one person and one person only, and that's the person who could have done something with him and may be responsible for his disappearance. Absolutely a possibility, but how far do we have to stretch the bands of logic to make that fit? Children are abducted every day, and it's a terribly sad thing. Parents look away for 30 seconds, and when they turn back, the child is gone. No indication of what happened, no witnesses, nothing. So we can't just completely throw this theory out as a possibility. The problem becomes when, over more than a decade later, nothing can be found to support this theory. There's a lot of rural, remote areas in upstate New York in which a body can be concealed. There's rivers and lakes. Hell, you don't even have to drive that far to get to the ocean. Unfortunately, there's a lot of ways in which someone could have come into possession of Jay and then done something horrible. When it all comes down to is whether or not you believe that Jay actually left his home that night on his own. A great many people, including police, do not. And that leads us to the final theory, that whatever happened to Jay is as a result of his adoptive father's actions. I did want to specify early on that I don't think this is a situation where we're dealing with a premeditated crime. Jocelyn McDonald passed her polygraph. She was cooperative with police. She answered all the questions they had to ask. I don't believe she was involved in a plot to eliminate Jay from her family's life. Now, that being said, there have been statements made that following the incident with Jay, where he allegedly threatened another student in the home group, that she drew a line and told Stephen that she no longer wanted Jay living in their home. This is why many people believe that Kerr took Jay to his parents' home. Not because it was easier, not because he didn't want to be disruptive, but because McDonald had told him, do not bring Jay back to this house. We know that about 8 days before Jay went missing, his father called a crisis hotline and began asking about the process by which to reverse the adoption. Now, reportedly, the person on the phone explained that that was impossible, and you simply couldn't reverse an adoption. That's not entirely true, though I wouldn't be surprised if Kerr had been told that, because a lot of parents probably call that number in the midst of chaos, and after they calm down, realize they're being rash in their choices. Either way, the respite home idea was suggested, and Kerr seemed eager to do it. So, Jay was taken to the home of Elaine and Thomas Persons, where he had been before. According to the Persons, Jay was fine during that time. He behaved well, did his homework, followed their instructions, and even wrote notes apologizing for his behavior, as they had asked him to do. Of course, this makes sense, as we know that Jay's fits, while difficult and trying, didn't typically last longer than an hour or so. Jay was set to stay with the Persons for 6 days, which he ended up doing. Following the final day, Kerr was to pick his son up, and he'd already been working on lining up another home for respite, though I'm not sure why, if he wanted to do that, he couldn't have just left Jay with the Persons for longer. Maybe they had a reason why they couldn't do it at the time. Either way, it was clear that Kerr was going to spend the night with his son and then give him to someone else for whatever period of time. Now, I'm not trying to judge Kerr or McDonald. I've been around kids, I know how it can be, and I'm fully aware that I'm not the right person to have children, which is why I don't. The problem for me with this situation is, it's not like they didn't know who Jay was. He lived with them for 5 years. They adopted him, he'd been around them, and they'd experienced his fits. Why all of a sudden were things so bad that he had to go? I know there's talk that he threatened to sexually abuse another student in the homeschool group, but according to all reports, the little girl's mother didn't think it was serious, and she knew that Jay had fits and had likely just blown up. If someone who isn't his parent could see that, why couldn't his parents? I can't begin to imagine what went on behind closed doors in the home. Maybe things were a lot worse than we'd imagine, maybe they weren't. Where things began getting strange is the night Kerr picks up Jay. Now, according to him, he followed a very specific set of roads spitting out onto Route 40, on which he drove most of the length back to Greenwich, where his parents' home was. Now, this is where the first major contradiction in the story comes in. While Kerr swears he drove the road he took, police find his phone pinged in South Troy, a town south of Greenwich that Kerr says he did not go to that night. He has said multiple times that he picked up Jay and went straight to his parents' home with no detours. Were that the case, why the hell was his phone down in Troy? He told authorities about the call he received, so he had to know they were going to track it. The person on the other end, who has never been identified but is apparently a friend of Kerr's, found his behavior on the phone so bothersome that when the police asked him, he referred to it as agitated. Now, that's a personal interpretation open to a subjective point of view, but you're probably not going to say that someone who is behaving normally was agitated. We don't know in what way Kerr was agitated, whether he was shouting or just responding with anger, but now we've got an apparently agitated man in an area he claims he never went on the same night he is last seen with his son, who will be missing by morning. The next strange detail is in regard to Kerr's van. Now, Kerr also claims to have driven straight to his parents' home. He and Jay never left the house again that night. Kerr drove a champagne-colored minivan at the time, and a similar style and color van was captured on surveillance cameras driving near the bank at approximately 12:16 a.m. There's a lot of champagne-colored minivans out there, or at least there were in 2007, but how many people living in Greenwich drove one? Oh, and did I forget to mention, the bank where the van was seen driving is located right behind the home. Sure, that's just a coincidence, though. So according to Kerr, he puts Jay to sleep, falls asleep himself, and sometime around 7:30 in the morning, he finds Jay's bed empty. Well, not completely empty. Pillows and clothes have been stuffed beneath the blankets to create the appearance that Jay is still in the bed. Kerr then discovers a note, which he alleges that Jay must have written and left behind, specifying that he's leaving. The note has been a major point of contention as well, as it does sound like it could be the note a child would leave before running away, but the persons alleged the note had been written in their house and was not about running away, but was about apologizing for his bad behavior. This, I suppose, depends on what you consider more likely, that a 12-year-old wrote a note because he was told to, or that he wrote this note in advance knowing that he was going to run away. You know, earlier I specified that I didn't think this was a case of premeditation, but now I'm wondering. The note that Jay wrote was allegedly due to Kerr telling the persons that his son needed to apologize. Is it possible that Kerr thought of this in advance to give him the excuse that Jay ran away? Well, maybe, but he'd really have no way of knowing what Jay would write and whether or not it would fit the scenario, so I don't know, what do you think? Following this timeline, Kerr doesn't immediately pick up the phone and call the police. This is strange because he found a note which he claims he believes suggested that Jay ran away. But instead of calling the police within 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, he waits 1 hour and 27 minutes calling them at 8:57 a.m. I understand you're going to shout for your child and look for him, but when it's clear he's not in the house and he's not answering outside, don't you think maybe you should call the police a little bit sooner? Almost from the first moment of the investigation, the police find flaws in Kerr's story. They simply don't believe it to be likely. They look because there's a possibility that Jay's out there on his own, but while officers are combing the woods, others are looking at Kerr and McDonald. They were asked to take polygraphs pretty quickly, and while McDonald agrees, Kerr doesn't. Now, I've explained before that I don't think someone refusing to take a polygraph is any indication of guilt, but it is a detail which, when combined with other evidence, may point the case in a particular direction. In this instance, it's yet another bump that chips away at the veracity of Kerr's initial story. So, what's the more likely scenario here? That a 12-year-old ran away on his own, managed to evade authorities, maybe was taken by someone else or ran off into the woods on his own, or that the man who spent his last night with him in a home all by themselves might know a bit more about what could have happened? Remember, Kerr's wife had told him Jay was out, she was done. No more. So now the guy has to choose between his wife and kids or his one adopted son. Obviously, many people will make the correct choice here or wait long enough for things to cool down, but what happens here happens quickly. Jay is gone, and there's nothing to indicate where he may be. Some people believe that Kerr made the decision that Jay had to go, and whether that was him doing something to the child or getting rid of him in some way is purely speculative. An interesting point is that if you don't want a child, there's options. Sure, you've adopted him, but take him to the state, take him to the hospital, a police department, wherever you've got to, and explain the situation. They can't force you to take the child home against your will, and they likely never would because that would be needlessly putting that child in danger. Kerr seems sort of like a dopey, gentle person. He doesn't strike me as a violent and vicious killer. And it does seem like these options could have been taken. But there's another possibility. Some believe Jay's fate may have been the result of an accident. What if things got out of hand? What if Jay had another fit? What if Kerr had had enough and things went too far? That I could see happening. It wouldn't be the first time a docile parent was moved to violence and made a terrible mistake. The problem with this is there isn't really anything to suggest it. It's not like there was blood in the home or signs of a struggle or anything which would suggest that Jay came to a violent end when things just built and built and finally exploded. Factor that in with the note, the pings of Kerr's cell phone, the surveillance footage, and it really does seem that out of all the possibilities, the most likely is that Jay never made it to the home that night. If that's the case, then there's one person and one person alone who knows what became of that sweet, innocent little boy. Jalik L. Rainwalker has been missing nearly 12 years, almost just as long as he was alive. During his short life, Jay touched many others, foster parents, teachers, friends, family. Many people still hold out hope that the answers will be found and Jay will be returned safely, while others hope only for the truth and a place to mourn their loss. 4 months after Jay vanished, his adoptive family moved across the state line. They still own the home in which Jay lived with them, They just don't live there anymore for one reason or another. All the while, all these years later, families that were in custody of Jay for a couple of months to a couple of years continue to push for answers, pay for billboards, send out flyers, gather media attention. While his adoptive family has done nothing. They're not out there beating the bushes, searching, putting up flyers, and trying to gather money for rewards. They don't even talk about it. And if they do, it's through a lawyer who continually expresses their belief that Jay will come home someday. While I hope that's true, it doesn't seem very likely. Unfortunately, the case is cold. The answers are hidden. The police, who have worked this case, have poured themselves into it. And while they believe they know what happened, they just need that one piece of evidence to make the case. I sincerely hope they find it. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Jaleek Rainwalker, there are many websites, forums, and archive news articles discussing his case. By searching Facebook for Jaleek Rainwalker, you can find a page run by family members in hopes of finding him. If you have any information about the vanishing of Jaleek Rainwalker, please contact the Cambridge Greenwich Police Department or the FBI. What do you believe happened?
Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group.
A special shout out goes out to Patreon producers Emily Smith, Kate Alexander, Megan Cotter, Randy Wyland, Tom Archer, Megan, Alicia Lorraine, Tara Doble, Eamon Brady, Chandra Moreau, Krista Colvin, and Deani Dyson.
If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row and can't wait to meet all of you. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.